From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. For the rest of this hour, the science of smell. From a whiff of morning coffee and some minty toothpaste onto car exhaust and your co-worker's bad breath, your day is filled with smells: fruity, earthy, floral, skunky, all of them sending a signal or maybe a warning and telling your brain something about the world around you. Of the five senses, none is as evocative and as elusive as smell. No one has come up with a reliable estimate of the number of scents in the world or a good way to classify them, but that hasn't stopped scientists from studying the aromas that drive, scare, or signal us, or simply take us back to a long-forgotten memory. My next guest makes his living studying smell and how it affects us, and he's written a book on the subject. Avery Gilbert is the author of What the Nose Knows. Get it? Nose Knows. The Science of Scent in Everyday Life, just out by Crown Publishers. He's a psychologist and smell scientist, and he joins me here in the NPR Bureau. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Gilbert.
Thanks, Joe.
And we're going to be interested in hearing your thoughts on smell, so by all means, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And, there's also some interesting links on our website, sciencefriday.com. And, you know, as I was just talking about, is smell sort of the Rodney Dangerfield of the senses? It doesn't get no respect?
It was the last to be explored, and only now do we actually have a sense of what the external wiring is. Back in 2004, the Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology went to Linda Buck and Richard Axel for finding the nature of the receptors that actually, high up in our nasal tissue, contact the odor molecules when they come in. And it turns out to be a huge gene family, an enormous number of different receptors. And so now we have a sense of what the wiring is, and we're kind of following it up into the brain and the psychology of the matter.
Well, tell us a little bit about, I mean, how is smell generated? Take us through from odor to sensation.
Well, an odor is a volatile molecule. It has to be light enough to float in the air and be inhaled up your nose, where it goes very high up in the nasal passages to a set of a little patch of tissue about the size of a dime that has sensory cells with little tendrils, spaghetti-like tendrils, on which are receptors. You can think of them like a baseball mitt, and the smell molecule is the baseball. When the baseball hits, it stimulates the cell to send a signal up into the brain. So that's the key first step, where you take a chemical message and translate it into an electrical message to the brain.
Okay. And if there's these large number of receptors and this mix that goes up to the brain, why is it proven so hard to categorize these things? I mean, for example, taste. We have five tastes, or color. We have primary colors, vision. Why is smell proven so elusive?
At a practical level, it's very difficult to measure. Scientists have had a hard time developing ways to present a standardized smell, for example. There's no kilogram of patchouli in that sense. There's no... So it's a nuisance in the laboratory, but more specifically, it's trying to come up with the categorization. We don't have a standardized rainbow in the same way that we have with the Newtonian rainbow. You know, colors, wavelengths of physical light in the real world are a continuous variable, mm-hmm. and it's our brain that creates the rainbows, the colors of the rainbow. In the same way, our brain is creating odor categories, but we haven't yet specified them in a way that's useful in the laboratory.
Hmm. Now, you talk about a device that's critical for odor chemists, this thing called a gas chromatograph, which actually takes the volatile elements in a particular thing and separates it into different chemical characteristics. Can you look at the output from a gas chromatograph and say, oh, that's an orange, or oh, that's a peach, or is something else going on in terms of how we perceive these things?
And a gas chromatograph coupled with what's called mass spectrophotometry enables you to do that. What you get is a chart that has little peaks on it, and those peaks and valleys are the odor fingerprint, if you will. And a trained chemist, somebody who's skilled in analyzing different sorts of samples, can look at a set of peaks and say that's probably a citrus fruit and it's probably an orange. But you or I couldn't.
But the cool thing is, and this is, you describe this in the book, okay, so we have, actually, just so we can do some real-life thing, we got a lime here, a lime with an earthworm. I mean, that's not an earthworm, an inchworm. So, okay, so this is a slice of lime, and yeah, No, that definitely smells like lime. So it's a lime. But if you wanted to create an artificial lime, you wouldn't have to have all the chemicals in lime to make me think I'm smelling a lime, right?
That's an interesting payoff from all the research that's been done since about the late 70s on chemical constituents of natural materials. So people have examined all kinds of food, raw fish, cooked fish, vegetables, fruits, and found that the same molecules keep turning up again and again. And in fact, Terry Acree, a professor of food science at Cornell, has found that probably less than 1,000 different molecules enable you to recreate any natural smell in the world.
Huh. And there was one other thing I wanted to point out. I mean, and we were talking about this earlier. So when I held this lime up to my nose, I was sniffing at it. And that's how you get the air, the volatile molecules up into the back of the nose where there's receptors are sitting waiting for whatever the smell is. But you describe there's different kinds of sniffers. Am I a typical sniffer or atypical sniffer?
You're a moderate sort of sniffer.
Moderate sniffer.
Yeah, there are some people who are very delicate. If you hand them a new smell in a bottle, they'll just take tentative little sniffs. And other people, like all kind of honkers, who are just, you know, really just inhaling again and again and again. You think they're going to hurt themselves. And every person has a kind of typical way of sampling smell.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, you can tell even behind the when I test subjects behind a screen, I can hear on the other side of the screen how they're sniffing. And I know if somebody takes 20 minutes with big honking sniffs, it's going to be a long day in the test lab.
I'm just wondering now that, you know, so with loud sounds, you can damage your hair cells in the inner ear. With bright light, you can damage the retinal cells. Are there smells that are so powerful that they can knock out your sensors?
Not really as smells. I mean, if you get a face full of pure chlorine in an industrial accident or something, you can burn your tissues, but
right. That's
at the extreme.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Well, I'm sure our listeners have a lot of questions that they'd like to ask, and so let me remind everyone, the number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's take a call now from Ryan in Greenville, is it Michigan?
Yes, it is.
Welcome to the program, Ryan.
Great. Thanks for taking my question.
Uh-huh.
I've heard in the news recently about the possibility of electronic transmission of smells, and I was just curious how that was possible and how the chemicals could be reproduced.
All right. Thanks for that call, Ryan. Electronic transmission of smells.
Well, actually, I was involved in a startup company some years back that was attempting to do just that. Basically, the idea is that you get a code, and you can make codes for different smells in the same way graphic artists have codes for different sorts of colors. And the code would correspond to firing off a little set of chemicals in a palette in a, say, a computer peripheral. And so you could click on a perfume ad, say, on screen and somewhere else. The code would fire a little device next to you, and you'd get a puff of that fragrance. So it's all in the software.
There was actually, you mentioned in the book, which we were toying with doing something like this, the idea that you could transmit smells over the radio. And of course, right now you can't, or at least not without specialized equipment on the receiving end. But you talk about somebody who played a joke on the audience once where he said, I'm going to play a tone now, and you should smell something and call us and tell us what you think you smelled. And people called in and said, oh, I smell bacon or I smell something. And they were actually lulled into thinking they could smell something.
Yeah, it was Michael Omani's famous experiment on the BBC in England. There's a lot of expectation that goes into what we smell. So it can bias us to expect certain things, good or bad. And in fact, you know, you were smelling a lime in consumer products that are lemon flavored. The expectation is that consumers want more than just a simple lemon. If you actually give them a simple lemon smell that's naturally accurate, they're going to be disappointed. So most lemon products smell like grapefruit.
Oh, God. I'm sorry. I want to take another call, but I have to say the other thing that really amazed me is that your smell is also affected by your expectation in terms of look. And you describe people who you pour the same wine into two different kinds of glasses, and they smell it in the different glasses, and they think it's two different wines, even though all they're changing is the glass.
That's right. Or if you have two different solutions with a smell in it, and you put a little food coloring in one and the other is clear, people sniffing the food colored one will think it smells stronger.
Interesting. All right, let's take another call now, and let's go to Ken in Houston, Texas. Ken, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you. I noticed when I was about 12 or 13 years old that I didn't really have a sense of smell, and at the time no one actually believed me, but just wondering if your guest can talk about that, what causes that and how common that is.
All right. Well, no smell at all, or no sense of smell at all.
Well, I guess Ken,
a very impaired sense. I mean, that's some very strong odors like ammonia I can detect, but often talk about the snow, things are snowing, and I really don't know what they're talking about.
Got it. All right.
Well, it's rare, but it's happened. I've met other people like yourself. When you're smelling ammonia, actually, that's not the olfactory nerve. That's the chemosensory nerves in your nose, the same way you might be able to smell vinegar or feel the chili pepper burn on your tongue and on your lips. So it's rare. It happens. Other people have lost sense of smell by a slight blow to the head, for example, or a bad flu. So I guess you've never really known what you've lost in a way. So you might be paradoxically better off than people who've known it and then lost it suddenly. I'm guessing.
Ken, thanks very much for the call.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Let's take another call now and go to, let me see here. Is it Judy in Portland, Oregon? Judy, welcome to Science Friday. Hi.
This is really interesting. I was telling the guy that, you know, taking the calls from people that my big smell that I love is vanilla. And inevitably, when I'm at a perfume counter and they're trying to sell me a new perfume, I'll go, oh, that's got vanilla in it, doesn't it? And sure enough, it does have vanilla in it. There's something about vanilla, even if it's masked slightly by musk or a floral smell, I inevitably smell the vanilla. And I was curious as to, you know, what causes that? I mean, just a personal preference, or if there really is something in your chemical makeup in the nose that lends you to smell a particular smell.
Well,
in the industry, vanilla is kind of notorious for being very – it penetrates through other combinations. That's why some of the vanilla-scented or vanilla-themed perfumes, for example, are mainly vanilla. It's hard to work with it. And on itself in the laboratory, it'll leak out of any bottle. It'll go through plastic. It's just – it's quite an aggressive smell.
You know, the other thing, speaking of vanilla, is I was doing some interviews with winemakers in Bordeaux. And they were saying that if they want to make a wine popular, they'll put a little vanilla flavor in it because it makes people like the wine better.
That's right. And there was a period where vanilla notes were very popular in colognes and perfumes, mainly perfumes for women, because they had a kind of edible quality to them. You smell that and you think cookies, you think sweetness, and it's very innocent. And so especially for a lot of younger wearing fragrances, it's a popular ingredient.
But, you know, just think that last sentence you just said is really interesting because you used notes, which is usually a term associated with music and hearing, and edible as in taste. So it's as if the smell can't stand on its own. It sort of has to rope in other senses, which I think is just an interesting thing about smell.
We're always groping for metaphors with smell, but perfumers tend to talk about notes for individual ingredients, and they talk about chords or accords, which are combinations of two or three such things. And the same, so it's got a very musical sense to it. There was a guy back in the 19th century who had the idea that smell worked on a musical system and that there was kind of an octave system he had all worked out. I don't know. He pulled it out of his head, really. It had no basis in fact, but it was an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Avery Gilbert. He's the author of What the Nose Knows, The Science of Scent in Everyday Life. I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take another call now and go to Christy in Novato, California. Christy, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you.
You bet.
I am a mom of two young boys, and I am fascinated with the smell of baby heads, and I'm not the only one, because even when you pass off your baby to someone else, they go, oh, the baby smell. And then somewhere between, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, they seem to lose that smell. It turns into a different one. So I've always kind of wondered about that. I assume it's something pheromones, bonding, but I would like to know if you know anything about that.
Cool. Interesting question. Thanks, Christy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great question. I hear it a lot, and I've experienced it with my own kids. There's that kind of clean baby skin smell that you get from young kids. And then, I don't know if it's like they grow out of it. I think it has to do also with diet and things like that. I mean, not to get indelicate, but baby poop from nursing infants is fairly inoffensive. You start feeding them the solid foods, and then the diaper changer becomes something you want your spouse to do. I think it's a lifelong process as well. Some recent work shows that there are reliable changes in character of body odor as people age, from middle age and on. So that's just one of the many things that's being kind of worked out now.
You know, one of the other things you talk about in the book is how mothers can recognize their baby's smell and find it pleasanter than other babies, even when it comes to baby poop.
That's right. It's not just using baby poop samples from the various kids in the nursery. It's not just mom thinking her kid smells better or less worse than the rest. You can actually you can back it up.
That's cool. We have time for one more quick call now. Kathleen from Rochester Hills, Minnesota. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yes, my husband has an absolutely awesome sense of smell, and it can also be kind of a detriment, he says. And I always tease him and say, well, maybe we can find out if there are other ways you can make money with that. Are there opportunities out there for such things where research labs utilize people with extra sensories that way?
Kathleen, thanks. Interesting question. What about that?
Yeah, he's got a future in quality control. I mean, you have to smell materials in the food industry, fragrance industry, to make sure they're in spec, make sure something's not off. I mean, you know, he could be a cheese inspector.
Are there, I've heard about super tasters. Are there super smellers, or do we know?
There are tons of super smellers in fiction all over the place. Salman Rushdie's written about them. That strange German novel, Perfume, the story of a murderer, is about it. But in real life, they don't exist. And the strange thing is that in terms of testing sense of smell, all the tests, the best you can achieve on them is being average and normal. There's no test that shows that you're a smell genius. In fact, it's very hard to define.
Yeah. Can you get better?
Yes, absolutely. It's a matter of training, the same way that wine tasting. If you have enough samples, you know, presented to you repeatedly and described to you, you build your own kind of internal memory system for it, and you can learn it. It's very rarely a case that perfumers are good just because of their physical nose. It's their brain.
And there's one other issue, and we only have a few seconds before the break, but humans versus dogs. Are dogs much better than we are? Are we as terrible as we think?
We're not as terrible as we think. And in fact, in many instances, we're on a par with dogs, surprisingly enough. Although there are differences in how we function. But for pure detection, we're close.
Really? Is there one species that is like the smelling king of the animal world?
I'm not ready to stump
him. That's great.
Well, I'm a real proponent that we're up there.
Okay. All right. Well, you know. That's good. We got to be good for something as human beings. I think it's fine if we are good at being smellers. Okay, we're going to keep talking about smell for the rest of this hour, and we're going to talk to a curator of an interesting exhibit that's currently underway in Philadelphia. So stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. A brief program note, next Wednesday, Talk of the Nation host Neil Conan will be back at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. That's the new museum dedicated to news and journalism. If you'll be in Washington and want tickets to join the audience for a live broadcast of Talk of the Nation, send an email to tickets@npr.org. This hour, we're talking about smell. My guest is Avery Gilbert. He's a psychologist and smell scientist and author of What the Nose Knows, The Science of Scent in Everyday Life. And smell might not be the first thing you think of when it comes to work of art, but for my next guest, the olfactory experience is the art form. Jim Drobnik is co-curator of the Odor Limits exhibition. You have one more day to take it in, so hurry. It's now showing or smelling at the Esther M. Klein Art Gallery at the Science Center in Philadelphia. Unfortunately, it closes tomorrow, but maybe Mr. Drobnik can tell us about it and see if it'll be somewhere else. Welcome to the program, sir.
Oh, good. Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
And if you'd like to ask questions about smell and this exhibit, please call us. The number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Why an art exhibit about smell? What were you trying to get at?
Well, it's an alternative way for artists to engage viewers and visitors. Smell is one of those sensory modalities that tends to be overlooked within our very audio-visual culture, and especially within the realm of art, which is so visually identified. We thought it interesting to look at artists who try to, either critique this kind of overemphasis on visuality and also who provide alternatives to that visuality.
And so how do you present art that incorporates odor?
Well, there's two ways. One is to include very fragrant materials. And another way is to create synthetic materials. Recent advances in chemistry and synthesis has greatly increased our ability to fabricate smells, ones that may exist in nature and ones that don't even exist in nature. So artists have been very keen to adapt this new technology to their own interests. And I guess there's a third way that artists address smell, and that is through symbolic means as well. There's a series of videos in the show, as well as a smell map that people can participate in. And so with these kinds of representations of smell, one can also consider how language and pictographic markings can also deal with smell.
Tell me a little bit more about the smell map. That sounds interesting.
Well, it's a piece by Jenny Marcoutou, and it's the third or fourth one that she's produced. She's done them in Spain, in Europe, and elsewhere. And she kind of looks at the tradition of smell maps, which go back to the 18th century. And smell maps were created during that time in order to identify noxious smells. And this was part of the great sanitization campaign that developed into cities with grand boulevards, septic systems, and sewers, and so on. But her map has a kind of different emphasis. Instead of identifying bad odors or foul fragrances, she tries to encourage and invite the audience to identify smells of all different types, such as flowering trees, bakeries or pizzerias, construction sites, and the kind of dustiness that occurs in those kinds of places. So it's really an attempt to increase people's attentiveness to the sense of smell in the city.
Right. Well, I'm just finally, it's too bad we caught you on this last day. Is there any chance that this exhibit will travel?
Well, you know, smell works tend to be quite performative and ephemeral, and also site-specific. So a piece like Jenny Marcoutou's smell map took an incredible amount of energy and time by the artist to situate it within the specific environs of Philadelphia. So, well, there's a hope. There's a chance. There's nothing in the works right now, but we're working on it.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jim Drobnik is co-curator of the Odor Limits exhibition running through tomorrow at the Esther M. Klein Gallery at the Science Center in Philadelphia. We're also talking this hour with Avery Gilbert. He's the author of What the Nose Knows, The Science of Scent in Everyday Life. And we've got lots of calls, so let's go to the phones and take a call from Daniel in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon. I've got a question I've always wanted to ask someone who might know. My 90-year-old dad, when he went back to school in his 30s, he shared with me something he tried when cramming for an exam, which was to slice open a lemon and sniff that while he was studying, and then bring a slice of lemon to the exam and try to trigger that. It has a mnemonic.
Interesting, mnemonic. Yeah, that's cool. Let me ask Avery Gilbert about that. What do you think about that?
It's a very reasonable idea. In fact, he's sort of hacking his own way to psychological insight that it's called site-specific learning. So you can see it in rats, you can see it in kids and adults, where things you learn in a specific room, for example, you can remember better in that room than in a different room later on. So put the smell up and then recreate the smell, and you're more likely to it's reasonable to think that you're more likely to recall the key information.
Cool. Now we have a question from Second Life from someone named Chuck Beatty. Are there perfumes that use multiple human pheromones? And maybe before you answer that question, I should get you to tell me if there is a difference between a pheromone and an odor, something that are they the same thing?
Pheromones and odors, that's a vexed question that is just now kind of being untangled. The idea of a pheromone is that it's a chemical substance that will cause a behavioral effect. In animals and insects, we think of it as mating pheromones, for example, and the effects are very specific and rigid and automated. Whether they whether pheromone effects even exist in primates, much less in humans, is kind of kicked back and forth. Martha McClintock at the University of Chicago thinks that pheromones are a kind of class of behavior that influences us sort of at the edges of awareness and at the margins, but it's not going to be a dramatic effect.
All right. Interesting. Well, let's take a call now from Connor in Somerville, Massachusetts. Connor, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
You bet.
I haven't heard the whole thing, so I hope I'm not repeating a question, but I had two questions. One, there's a phenomenon I've experienced, I know others have, where a very particular smell will trigger extremely vivid memories, and you'll be able to know exactly what the memory was. It's the exact smell you've smelled some time before. And I've never experienced quite the same effect with either any of the other senses, vision, taste, tactile, nothing else. And I was wondering if your guest could speak to that phenomenon. And then my second question is, with the way that humans have a sensitivity to a certain spectrum of light that we call the visible range, and other animals can see more into infrared, and honeybees and some birds can see more into ultraviolet, is there a similar spectrum when it comes to smell? And are there, you know, smells that we just as humans can never smell but other species can?
Cool. Those are two really good questions, Connor. The first one, smell and memory.
That's a very common experience, and it's this kind of instant and highly vivid evocation of the past is something that is unique in its feeling to smell, because in other modalities, when we remember the past or we were learning something typically. So in grade school, we learn the names of the state capitals, and in adulthood, it's not remarkable to know that whatever the capital of North Dakota might be. Joe's shaking his head. I can't remember it either at the moment, but we made an effort to learn it once, and so it's not so remarkable when it comes back to us. Now, with smell, smell's kind of always covering its tracks in a way. We don't make a conscious effort to remember every smell as we pass through it, and yet it can kind of leave a trail. Procedural memory is what psychologists call it. It kind of imprints itself on a series of events, and then when we come across it years later, it just reawakens that whole sequence in a very vivid way, often misattributed to Marcel Proust, the novelist. But as I point out in the book, he probably got it wrong, and there's a lot of American authors that capture the spirit of it much better.
And what about this, Bismarck, North Dakota. what about the other point of certain smells that are just beyond our ability, but maybe some other species can capture?
That's probably true. In many ways, the natural smells in the world, the volatile smells, aren't there for us. They're there for insects talking to insects, plants talking to insects, and vice versa. And we're just eavesdropping on these other interspecies conversations that go on. One of the interesting outcomes of the new work on the genetics of odor reception is that we can see how similar our receptors are to those of mice, say, or apes, or rabbits, and so forth. Turns out with chimpanzees, the kind of families of odor receptors that we have very closely map onto chimpanzee ones. But even with mice, what the kind of groupings, and here it's a little speculative because we haven't nailed down a particular smell to a particular receptor, but it's very likely that what we're smelling in the world in written large is what a mouse is smelling in the world, and vice versa.
Hmm. Now, there's been suggested that certain smells are somewhat iconic for certain things, and we have some lavender there,
right.
That came from someone's garden.
It's maybe. Great. It's very fresh.
Yes, very fresh.
Yeah.
It's a nice smell, but somehow it seems to be associated with spinsterhood, or
in this country it is. Lavender is one of the favorite ingredients for aromatherapists around the world, mm-hmm. and it's a popular smell. It has a connotation of calmness and calming when the aromatherapists talk about it, and it's used in a lot of products in Europe with that kind of a positioning. In this country, we tend to think of it as old ladies and grandma's closet, sort of.
Hmm.
It's not an exciting smell.
Seems to me I was in a field in France once where there were just rows and rows of
It's still grown there, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. All right, let's take another call now and go to Vincent in Long Island, New York. Welcome to the show, Vincent.
Thank you. How are you guys today?
Good.
Good. I had a question in regards to why is it that when humans smell certain obnoxious odors that it makes us nauseous or making us want to be very sick? Whereas dogs who also have a strong sense of smell don't seem to be affected by odor in any way like that.
Good question. Vincent, thanks.
Yeah, excellent. I think it's because we attribute meanings to smells, and the dogs are sort of taking them at face value in a way. smell to a dog is just a fact out in the world and doesn't have a lot of value to it. And we start thinking about, oh, that's the smell of a horrible, you know, blood and guts in a car accident or a slaughterhouse or something. We start thinking about the implications of that. I think that helps bring up the nausea in a way.
Hmm. Interesting. We're talking with Avery Gilbert. He's the author of What the Nose Knows, The Science of Scent in Everyday Life. I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I guess we have to bring up one other question. Well, two parts of the same question. I know I'm asking for trouble here, but men and women, different ability to smell?
Yeah, that's one of those areas where conventional wisdom is actually correct. Women claim to be able to smell better and be more sensitive, and we have to give them that.
Okay.
On average, a woman can smell, detect an odor at a lower concentration in the air, and women are generally able to identify them more readily, more quickly, which goes with a kind of female advantage in verbal ability
right.
over us guys.
But now let's flip it around, women, in terms of how they smell, there's a section in the book that I can't let go. This is the difference between male and female farts. And you say it's been scientifically shown that volume, ounce for ounce, women have smellier farts than men.
That's true. There's a research group using gas chromatography, as you mentioned, a very cool technique. And it's finally been put to this age-old question that's been argued for centuries. Guys have been insisting that mm-hmm. women are stinkier ounce for ounce, and they're correct.
Mm-hmm.
The offsetting fact, though, is that guys produce more gas, and so I think it's a draw in the end,
I see.
So to speak.
See, I told you, Annette, we were going to get to that. Annette didn't put that down as one of the questions, but she's the producer. I get to ask the questions. And let's go let's go to another caller now and take Kat. Is it Karthik from Apex, North Carolina?
It is Karthik from Apex, North Carolina.
Welcome to
Thank
the show.
You. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I just had a quick question about the comment that there's an array of, say, 1,000 chemicals that trigger smell responses. Is there an individual receptor for each one of these, or is there a signature of interactions that each chemical triggers that then is read as a particular chemical by our brain?
Interesting. Very interesting. What about that? Do we have a receptor for 1,9,5-all something, or do they get mixed up somehow?
That's a great question. Actually, there's a PhD to be pursued there if you want to. It's a really hot topic right now. It seems as if a given chemical will probably stimulate 2, 3, 4 more receptors to greater or lesser degree. And just figuring out how they overlap with each other in their receptive fields, again, talking metaphorically, is of great interest in the neuroscience community now, because that will help us figure out the kind of the psychological code for how smells are transferred, again, from a chemical structure into a psychological coding and an experience.
So what's the worst thing you've ever smelled?
I'm not a fan of vomit in any form.
Mm-hmm.
I can do the diaper cleaning routine, but the vomit gets me.
Hmm. There's one that I remember. Maybe somebody – I worked in a lab, a biochemical lab for a while, and there was this chemical that was used for staining DNA or something called beta-mercaptoethanol, BME. And, I mean, they open a vial of that anywhere in the building, and it was like run for your life. It's got sulfur in it. Sulfur seems to be at the root of a lot of not-so-nice smells.
Right. I mean, that's your basic fart ingredient. And there's a lot of sulfur-containing mercaptan smells. I mean, the mercaptans are the mixture of them are used as a warning signal in natural gas, for example. Yeah, they're often the culprits.
All right. Well, I'm afraid that's where we're going to have to leave it for this very, very interesting discussion. I hope everybody has learned that smell is something we should both pay attention to, admire, use when we need to, and appreciate for all the complexities that it has. Thanks for joining us, Avery.
My pleasure.
This program is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Bergquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Our interns are Christopher Intagliata and Liz Burns. Josh Rogerson is our technical director, and he's at the controls here in New York City. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, Room 306, New York, New York, 10036. You can also email us. The address is scifry@npr.org. Check out Science Friday for more information and links to ScienceFriday.com, that is, for information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. And check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curriculum materials for teaching science and using Science Friday. Just click on the teacher's link on ScienceFriday.com. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.